Okay.
You ready, girl?
Yeah.
Okay. Can you bring me the public comment sheet, please?
Do you want to make that announcement, though?
I will. So, we realized that we erred on the agenda a little bit. So what we're going to do is, for those of you who are here to do public comment, we will have a separate public comment period because there is going to be a proposed motion on water typing. If you are here to public comment on water typing, we'll do that as another public comment period before the board takes action. And so it's a little after one, so if people have anything they would like to say, address other than water taping, this would be a good time to hear from you. So, why don't we go around the table and then we'll also take note of the cake over there. So, Paula, would you lead off, please?
And are these our usual just perfunctory name and our position on the board type introductions?
Correct.
It's not like, oh, I'm a child.
Did you want to get in the touchy feely stuff?
All right. All right. Just wanted to know what you're looking for. So, I'm Paula Sodine, general public member.
I'm Bob Gunther, and I represent the small landowners.
Carmen Smith, represent the contract loggers.
Heather Balish, director's designee from the Department of Commerce.
Court Stanley, general public member.
Tom Lurie, ecology.
Stephen Bernath, designee as chair of the board.
Lisa Janet Key, Skagit County Commissioner, representing the counties.
I'm Dave Herrera, general public member.
My name is Patrick Gaffer, I'm with the Washington State Department of Agriculture.
I'm Brent Davis, general public.
I'm Joe Storr. I'm a middle-aged man looking for the truth. I'm the deputy director of Fish and Wildlife.
How do you top that?
Bill Little, I represent the timber workers unions.
Well, we clearly haven't had a sugar low yet. So as I mentioned this morning, we went out and got a cake this morning celebrating the 10th anniversary of the ACP. So board members and the public, as the sugar low goes down, you can pick it up with all that icing over there. Okay, so I am going to call out names and just check in to make sure that the reason you're here is not to comment on water typing, and then we'll have a separate water typing public comment period, okay? So Wyatt Golding, you're going to wait?
Oh, no, I'm not commenting on water typing.
So are you, so right. Come on up then.
Oh, okay,
please.
Sorry, I thought you were going through.
No. Sorry, I wasn't clear.
Fuzzy-headed. All right. Good afternoon, members of the board. I'm here on behalf of the Skykomish Valley Environmental and Economic Alliance, Defenders of Wildlife, and the Northwest Center for Alternatives to Pesticides. In April, before your last meeting, we filed a petition for rulemaking, asking for better notice to the surrounding community about aerial application of forest chemicals and reporting after the fact. At this board and DNR's request, we withdrew that petition in order to engage with conversations with stakeholders. Reporting back, we've had those discussions. We learned a lot in those discussions from everyone and appreciate the effort that was put into it. Particularly DNR staff put a lot of work in, came forward with some interesting creative solutions that would implement new technology with FPARs. There's some good ideas. What was clear from the meetings is that there's a pretty fundamental impasse about notifications, the core of our petition. Our understanding from the timber industry representatives is that they don't believe there should be any sort of consistent guidelines or rules on how notification happens, but rather be up to a landowner by landowner basis. Our clients believe that there's reasonable concern, and the best course in the face of that concern is to choose a transparent, affirmative outreach that's consistent across the landscape. What that looks like is affirmative efforts to reach out, let people know what's going to happen so they can be informed. It's also clear there's a pretty big disparity between landowners and what they do. Some landowners, we learned, are very conscientious and engaged, know their community well, in other cases, less so. But our concern with a somewhat ad hoc landowner by landowner system is that in the cases where there's less notification, basically the applicator is deciding how much information people should get. We believe that decisions, how to assess risk should be in the public rather than the person doing the application. So given that our plan is to, in a few weeks, refile our petition, we're going to do it in a manner that reflects the great deal we've learned. I think it's going to be refined. I know it's going to be refined to reflect some of the steps DNR is taking. We're going to do it in a timely manner so that there shouldn't have to be a special session. And what we ask for this board is that between now and then, for you to please engage in this process. I know there's a lot of work that's gone into planning a science session on October 25th that hopefully will answer some of your questions about what is the level of risk, what are the chemicals being used, all that sort of valuable information. And I'm hopeful that we'll file our petition well ahead of time. You can engage with that. And we'd be happy to meet with any of you personally, talk on the phone, whatever is helpful. What we want to do is bring something discreet and concrete and resolvable to this board in November so we can move forward in a productive manner. So I appreciate your time. You'll next hear from Megan Dunn. She's going to focus on chemicals themselves, risks that we believe are imposed by them. And then you'll hear from Vanessa Pierce on community impact. Thank you.
Megan Dunn.
My name is Megan Dunn. I'm the Healthy People and Communities Program Director with NCAP, the Northwest Center for Alternatives to Pesticides. We're a 40-year-old organization working to inspire ecologically sound alternatives to reduce the use of pesticides. I'm an appointed member of the Washington State Pesticide Advisory Board and a member of the Pesticide Program Dialogue Committee, which is a broadly representative federal advisory committee. Compared to other states and based on best practices recommended by the EPA and state departments for agricultural use, Washington lacks appropriate monitoring, enforcement, notification, and pesticide use reporting. As we met with stakeholders over the last month, there was disagreement about whether or not there is risk to local landowners as a result of chemical spraying. And while reasonable minds may differ about the degree of risk, scientific study and local accounts of exposure in forestry clearly document risk. The scientifically documented health impacts include both acute and immediate health effects for workers and residents who may be victims of drift, as well as long-term impacts from exposure, such as increased risk of cancer, liver disease, autism, depression, diabetes, autoimmune disorders, and reproductive issues. So one example is a sulfometron methyl, which is known as DuPont's Oust Extra. This was used in an incident that was reported to the Department of Health, where a forestry worker was applying this herbicide mix to a hilly terrain. The wind blew the spray into his face. He was not wearing protective eye gear, and he began experiencing ocular symptoms. This chemical can persist in soil for a year and is extremely potent. It's about 100 times more toxic to plants than other herbicides. Alice causes eye discomfort, blurred vision, and has been found to cause anemia and reproductive complications, including fetal loss. So since 2001, there have been 13 health-related incidents reported to the Department of Health, including Christmas tree farms, and four of those incidents were drift onto nearby homes. Reported symptoms included gastrointestinal, neurological, and ocular. Updated federal protection standards will apply to forestry pesticide applications, and these standards will require pesticide records for emergency response, additional training, and notification. So with these new requirements, foresters and DNR will already need to adjust their current practices. Several states require standards for notification of nearby and adjacent residents, including Maine and Minnesota, and pesticide use is required in states from Arizona to California to New York and Oregon. There's been consistent public outcry to chemical use in forestry and many comments submitted to the DNR, and communities are understandably worried about the impacts of these pesticides being exposed where they live, work, and play. So it's clear there are simple steps that foresters and DNR can take to maintain our working forests in a sustainable manner and protect human health, many of which are good business practices, such as working collaboratively with the local community to provide effective notice and accurate record keeping. So we look forward to continuing this conversation and understanding how we can improve transparency and better protect our workers, residents, and Washington's forests. Thank you.
Thank you. Anessa?
Good afternoon. Thank you for this opportunity to speak to you today on an important issue impacting our community and environmental health and safety. My name is Anessa Pius. I live in Skokomish Valley, and this is east of Everett in Snohomish County. Skokomish Valley is well loved by our state, national, and international visitors for its recreational opportunities and is known for our growing tourism industry. My neighborhood alone has hundreds of homes, numerous families with children, businesses, farms, and organic farms, gardens, and orchards. My education includes a master's degree in chemical technologies engineering, and I have extensive experience working with chemicals. Currently, I own a recreational lodging business, Rocky's Retreat. I'm also the president of SVENA, Skokomish Valley Environmental and Economic Alliance. SVENA is a young grassroots nonprofit organization formed after a 1,000-acre herbicide spray in September 2015 on three farms in southern startup area. Many herbicides are toxic chemicals that pose a tremendous threat to public health and safety and to the environment. Last September, there was no advanced warning to the residents of southern startup community for this huge spraying operation. Thousands of residents and tourists observed for 4 days helicopters with clouds of unknown chemicals being spread around them. Local citizens were horrified and upset. Personally, I was deeply disturbed and worried. Veterans said it reminded them of a Vietnam operation for spraying Agent Orange. It took me two weeks to find information about the chemical spraying and rates of application. In 2 weeks after the spray, the forester informed me saying, quote, "I do not currently have time to review all our spray records to see what was sprayed and when. Sometime this winter I may have some time available," unquote. Between August 29 and September 23rd of this year, Weyerhaeuser Corporation is planning a chemical spray on over 803 acres in the Gold Bar area and east of Gold Bar. People living in those areas do not know anything about what is coming, timing of the spray, chemicals, and safety around those chemicals. Many residents will, like me, be deeply afraid upon seeing the spraying helicopter. The fear created by spraying is a real problem that this board has the power to easily eliminate with simple and reasonable policy steps. Widespread and consistent investigation to residential community within a certain vicinity of aerial spraying would reduce the factor of fear, panic, and conflict. Give people more information about an aerial application and let people plan how to be safe and how to safeguard our children. We are simply asking for increased transparency and to give people in the community an opportunity to make their own decisions about how to assess the risk of chemical exposure. Thank you for your consideration on this important matter.
Thank you. Alex and Peter, are you talking, you want to talk about water typing?
Yes, water typing.
Okay, so we'll hold you until later.
Well, I'm actually doing a Clean Water Act.
Sure, he's somewhere. I don't know if you want to do that now.
Oh, no, that'd be fine.
Good afternoon, everyone. My name is Alex Seidels. I'm from the Washington Forest Law Center. And my comments today are kind of a follow-up to Mark Hicks from the Department of Ecology, who we heard this morning talking about the progress made in Clean Water Act assurances. And the Forest Law Center has been talking this over with DNR as well. And our concern is that the Clean Water Act assurances are falling behind schedule. In fact, they're already far behind schedule in many cases. And Mark Hicks did a really good job of explaining where all of that stood, you know, the good news and the bad. So some of the studies that are required have been done, but a lot of the other ones have not. And the ones that haven't are kind of big ones. And without the completion of the required studies, there's no basis to believe that our current forest practices rules are being complied with or are actually protecting water quality. They might be, they might not be, nobody knows, nobody can know. So among other things, we don't know if the perennial initiation point is being protected adequately. We don't know if there's compliance with unstable slope rules. We don't know if the small forest landowners are implementing the road maintenance and abandonment plans. We don't know if rule identified landform identification is adequate. We don't know the cumulative effects on a watershed scale and on intermittent stream ecosystems. So there's just a lot of knowledge gaps, and without them, it's really difficult to say, you know, with any kind of assurance that the water quality is being protected in the way it needs to be. These are not minor details. I mean, we're talking about thousands and thousands of miles of streams and protections to listed species that the HCP is supposed to protect. So this is not kind of an ancillary issue out there. So what we would ask is for the board to direct DNR to make Clean Water Act assurances a top priority. And we would like this board to set aggressive timeline and reporting requirements. And we would like the board to request minority-majority reports when consensus does not quickly occur. We've learned over the last 20 years that when there's a process that allows any stakeholder to veto any stage of the study design and implementation, that process just does not achieve the desired results. And then the end state is what Mark Hicks briefed us on this morning, where, you know, we just have these big knowledge gaps, and we're kind of, you know, making rules in the dark as a result. We think that if this board takes a more affirmative role in Clean Water Act assurances, it can create stronger incentives in the adaptive management process for stakeholders to compromise. I mean, if it's clear that the board is pushing this issue, consensus will become easier to achieve, And especially if the board accepts majority-minority reporting, then, you know, the board can make real decisions, even in those individual cases where consensus is simply not attainable in any kind of reasonable time frame. Quick and effective action by the board is essential because the next expiration of the assurances is coming up. And at this point, there's no reasonable basis for further extensions. So I would like to thank the board for its work on this issue already. I appreciate your efforts, and thank you for considering my comments as well.
Ben Hansen.
Hi. My name is Heather Hansen, representing Washington Friends of Farms and Forests. I've been working on education about pesticide issues for almost 20 years. I'd like to start by saying, just pointing out that both the products that are being used and the way they are used are regulated at the federal level by EPA and at the state level by the State Department of Agriculture and the Department of Labor and Industries, as well as in some situations by the Department of Ecology and, of course, forest practices. Washington's forestry applicators are already providing more information to the public through the forest practices application and through required physical posting than nearly any other pesticide applicator anywhere else in this country. Information is important. We're doing a great job through our existing notification system. Both through the forest practices application and then through FPARS, we have a notification system. Now, I'll be the first to admit, it's not as user-friendly as it could be. And because of that, way back last spring, we went to DNR and said, you know, we know that the forest practices application is confusing for a lot of people when they look at it. And so we'd like to improve the form and make it a little more user-friendly, a little easier to understand. We're going to continue to do that. We're working on that. We have some ideas. I think you'll hear a little more about that later. And we're going to continue that. We also know that DNR has some ideas about how to make FPARS a little bit more user-friendly. And that's great, too. The easier information is to access and understand, the better for everybody. So we have a lot of good things happening. In addition to those two, we also have DNR just posted their new web pages dealing with forest chemicals. I think those will continue to evolve and more information will be added there. In addition, we hope that as the FPARS system gets easier to use on the web page, I hope there's a tutorial there that will help people understand how to sign up for FPARS and use it. Again, just to make it easier to access the information and easier to understand. You heard about the CEMER science session on pesticides is coming up. We're looking forward to that. The more we can do to help make pesticide use easy to understand and take the fear out of it, the better for everybody involved. So we are dedicated to improving communication, and would be happy to hear your ideas about other types of communication improvements. Thank you.
Thank you. Mary, Elaine, and Karen, I'm assuming you're just commenting on water typing. Is that correct?
Water.
Okay, John Saris.
What's your time zone? Thank you.
Sorry, John. I'm focused totally on you now.
Okay. Great. I'll state my name in Chaskwisai I in Chapin Sukanakin Pasquas. My name is John Cyrus. I work for the Upper Columbia United Tribes, and I just wanted to address the Cultural Resources Roundtable and some of the effort that's going on with that, just to give some perspective from my point of view. We're going through some rough times right now, and the Tribal Caucus is meeting to try to figure out ways how to re-engage and how to reflect on the current process, and many tribes have concerns. While we haven't yet come together yet to figure out how we're going to put this into writing for the board, but I think just with some of the tribes that I work with, the Caldwell, Spokanes, and Kalispells, there is some concern whether or not it's worth staying involved in the process. If their concerns aren't being heard or met, you know, that's serious enough for them to consider whether or not they should stay involved. And you know, I think for many of us, we're wondering how are we complying with HCP that is there to protect cultural resources. Our past meeting where we had several tribal reps come here and give a really beautiful presentation about cultural resources, and we're grateful for that opportunity. We need to continue to ask ourselves, how are we doing in that process of protecting cultural resources? And from many of the folks that we work with, we're not doing a very good job of it right now. I think we've got several interesting develops on the horizon, with Tim Thompson being hired on as a facilitator. You know, I think as a roundtable, we weren't informed of taking TerraCon out of the process, the previous facilitator. So it is kind of a roller coaster ride right now in terms of, you know, what direction that's heading in. And then having Mark Engel and Joan McGurr out to visit and interview, working with tribes at their places of work, I think recently has been quite a bright spot in terms of getting some real feedback from tribes and looking at the future. So yeah, we look forward to continuing to work on this issue and inform you all of what's going on, and to make sure that you're all aware of how we're moving forward with cultural resources and how that's being played out. Thank you.
Thank you, John. Mark Goudier.
Assuming you're not talking about water typing?
Not talking about water typing. Okay. Wearing pants this time. You remember last year at this time, I was wearing shorts and I had to explain myself. So, out of respect to you guys, I put on the pants this time. So thank you. Thank you very much, board, and thank you, chairman. I just wanted to comment really quick on the herbicide petition. As you all know, the UCUT also put forward a petition on the herbicide, and also in an effort to be collaborative and to give respect to the board, we rescinded that petition in an effort to work collaboratively. So like you heard from other folks, there was some bright spots in that collaborative effort. One of the most encouraging things, and to remind you, kind of our main issue is the reporting issue, and just simply knowing ultimately and flexible on when that information gets delivered, what chemical was actually applied on the ground. So for the reporting issue, one of the encouraging things is hearing about the revamping of FPARs and the fact that it possibly could accommodate the need for the reporting and the notification piece. We could utilize that tool and hopefully whittle down that expected cost of industry to do that reporting, knowing that was one of the main concerns and something we're hoping to tackle. So I'm encouraged by that. I'm hopeful that FPARs could provide that. Another encouraging step is that, you know, people are talking about continuing to have this discussion over the next 3 months. So the UCUP welcomes any opportunity to meet with industrial landowners. We will continue to engage this conversation and try to work collaboratively to come up with any solutions before having to come back to the board in November to, you know, deal with the petition. So we will continue to work on that. But I also just want to share with you kind of the extent of the issue in our region, in the Northeast region. I mean, basically 15 years ago, there was 0 acres being sprayed in the Northeast region. It just wasn't the way we operated. Site prep was done mechanically or in other methods, and herbicides weren't being used. This year, I just did a quick tally of the FPAs that come across my desk, and this isn't all of them, but already we've had 7,000 acres sprayed just in the Northeast region this year. And a lot of those spray applications are coming in the burned areas. So It's basically a double whammy for our tribal members in that these areas have been burned, and now they're coming in and spraying the regeneration. And one of the, you know, one of the few benefits to fire is that regeneration often is very productive first foods. And so our tribal members will actually go out into these burned areas to collect, and now they're being sprayed. So in addition to that, right now is when the huckleberries are ripe, the elderberries are ripe, and the chokecherries are ripe, you know, all major first foods. So again, we have tribal members out collecting these first foods, and you know, all we need to be able to do is know what chemicals are being used, so we can give tribal members the appropriate, you know, information as natural resource directors or natural resource managers. You know, that for like the example that was used, oust is known to stay and persist for a year. Well, you know, you might want to avoid collecting your choke cherries on the margins of that clear cut for the next year. It's just simple kind of right to know type of issue. So we just, again, just appreciate, absolutely appreciate the effort that the DNR staff made, that everybody's making to try to collaboratively work on this, but unfortunately we still haven't resolved this reporting issue. So we just appreciate the board's efforts, and we'll continue to work on this, and we'll be back in November to hopefully get to resolution. So thank you.
Thank you, Mark. Mark and Jeff, you're gonna be part of the presentation then, right?
Yeah.
So okay, thanks. I just wanted to verify that. Jeffrey?
Yeah, can I squeeze in?
You can, you're last.
Okay, great, thank you, I appreciate that. So my name's Jeffrey Thomas, I'm the director of the Puyallup Tribes Timber Fish and Wildlife Program, and I am co-chair of the cultural, PFW Cultural Resources Roundtable. I want to make some comments on behalf of the Puyallup Tribe today, just a couple of comments pertaining to the cultural resource protection work that we're all working towards together. But anyways, here's my current outstanding concerns. I just have two of them. One is that I'm concerned about the uncertainty, the current uncertainty regarding the Tim Thompson process. But, you know, we're not sure, at least the Puyallup Tribe's not real clear on what is the overall strategy or the expected outcomes of this WDNR-sponsored facilitation process. We need some detailed clarification regarding how the TFW tribes can expect for their issues to be addressed. So just, it seems to, you know, be a real big gray area. We're just not sure how we're going to go from A to Z. The other one is that we'd really like to see some, we want to just highlight for you that we believe there's a specific need to underscore that the purpose of the TFW Cultural Resources Roundtable is to help tribes, help them fulfill their role as participants in all phases of regulating forest practices as set forth in the FFR. I say this because that seems to be the perception, the working perception that applies for, say, for example, the DNR Small Forest Landowner Advisory Committee. The perception is that they're there to help small forest landowners, and that those are the topics that should, focused on, you know, it should be the focus of their work. That's what tribes believe the TFW Cultural Resources Roundtable is there for, to help them. And if that's not what they're there for, then I think tribes really need to know. So those are my two comments for y'all. Thank you.
Thank you, Jeffrey. All right. So let's move to water typing. Adrian Ray and Hans, you guys want to get set up? So I'm just going to read some information to sort of set up the discussion this afternoon. As you all recall, the board a year ago passed a motion setting some expectations on water typing. And I've provided that in your data packets to review. But one of the things that, in addition to the policy group has been really good about reporting back on progress every quarter, and we appreciate that. And we we know that there's a lot of work going on in the background, and we appreciate that. But I wanted to reread just a piece of this motion before we actually get into their report on how it's going. And I want to remind the board that generally, expectations we set was that they would be using existing information. They would be developing a method for addressing streams not on the hydro layer, making methods as accurate as possible, balance error, minimize electrofishing, improve the map over time, develop methods to locate stream breakpoints on the ground, and ensure methods address small forest landowners. Of course, we have the deadline for policy to bring us, as best they can, recommendations by the next meeting in November. So with that, I'll leave it to you guys to start up. Are we going to, you want to talk a little bit about the status of the matrix, Adrian, and then I'm assuming we'll get into the water type modeling project after that.
I think that would be fine.
Or do you have a better suggestion?
No, that'll work. First of all, before we go there, I'd like to introduce myself and then someone else to the left of me here. My name's Adrian Miller. I'm the co-chair of TFW Policy. And I'd like to emphasize the co today because also before you is Ray Entz of the Kalispell tribe. And he has agreed for a yet to be determined period of time to serve as co-chair. And I'm immensely grateful for both his personal involvement as well as the tribe's support of him in that role. So I wanted to get that out of the way. Matt, you don't have to introduce yourself.
Thank you, Ray. We really do appreciate you helping out.
It's your fault.
Good afternoon, Chair, members of the board. I'm Hans Burge. I'm the Adaptive Management Program Administrator.
So I think what we're going to do today is I'm going to talk a little bit about just sort of the matrix as a document and kind of what its purpose is at the moment and where that may evolve to, and then we'll get into the substance of the issues. If you recall, this was an attempt early on in our deliberation of the various issues to try to sort of understand how different elements of the water typing system related to each other. So this was a tool actually developed by a staff person at DNR to help sort of track progress early on and a way to sort of see how things are filling in. I've been using the metaphor of a funnel. Where if you think of to the left of the matrix is the small end of the funnel, and as you add more detail, the funnel widens and widens and widens. We're actually at a point, and I look at this largely success as part of some of our successes, is that the ability to transcribe information accurately, concisely, is outgrowing the tool. So we'll be working on a way to sort of transition from the formal matrix that was adopted into sort of more discrete policy recommendations that will actually be sort of flushed out. And it'll still be a useful tool, I think, for the co-chairs and the AMPA and policy to track where things are. But I need a little more space than one column on a paper to put in what we're working on. So with that, we're going to kind of go over the main topics that are embedded in the matrix. If we miss something or folks have a question on a specific piece, we can go through that. I think Ray and I appropriately own the off-channel habitat component, the electrofishing component, and the physicals component. And I think the AMPA will be addressing some of the mapping pieces as well, so the model. I'll start off with off-channel habitat, and then I'll give a brief introduction, and if you want to add anything to it, either one of you. So where we're at, we're actually at sort of the fisher cut bait stage on this particular issue, where we're actually completed with the technical review. We've taken a look at existing information and are beginning to develop actual policy recommendations. I think we're probably a meeting away or so from finalizing those. There's, you know, still a few questions that need to be answered, but I think there is emerging consensus around that part of the Type F process. I think we'll be probably looking at some form of new definition of off-channel habitat that's focused more on physical characteristics of the stream as opposed to biological indicators on the land. I think with that will come clearer guidance for how to implement that in the field through probably some direction to a board and annual process. And we may discuss the opportunity for some additional research on that topic. I think that's still very much up in the air in terms of how different caucuses perceive the level of uncertainty around our decision, whether or not it makes sense to invest money in trying to solve that remaining uncertainty. So I'll pause there. Ray, is there anything to add or Hans there? If it's okay with you, Chair Bernath, I think I could stop and do questions by topic, or we could wrap them up at the end. However you
Why don't we do it by topic?
Okay.
And so I'll just ask if there are any board questions regarding status of off-channel habitat.
All right.
Board members,
what do you? Oh, I'm sorry.
It's okay. Couldn't let you get away with that.
I like this topic.
So, can you summarize for us in the assessment you've done how, kind of trying to figure out the right way to phrase this, have you been able to determine how much the original articulation of the issue sort of held as everybody was exploring? What I remember is that there was quite a bit of concern just about the way the rule was written and implemented, that there was quite a bit of off-channel habitat that was not being identified and not being protected. And so as this discussion has gone on, can you give a quick overview of how the current picture of the issue is?
So with respect to rule implementation, I probably can't answer that question. We didn't do any kind of, you know, compliance audit or anything like that to look at implementation. What I would say is there's probably a range of opinions around that statement. Regardless of where you fall on that range, I think the guidance in the board manual existing today is not as good as it could be. And I think the way off-channel habitat is defined today makes it challenging for both practitioners and regulators and the public to determine exactly your question. And so that's a shifty way of not answering your question directly, but what I would focus on is I think folks recognize that and recognize that regardless of whether or not it is or isn't being missed in practice, that there's a good rationale for some improvement to avoid that. Whether it is or isn't happening now, I can't speak to. I don't know if the technical group touched on that at all. I don't think they really did much.
They did. They just basically pointed out that there would be a significant amount of research or study that would need to be done to determine what portion of that is being missed by the current definition of off-channel habitat. So rather than chasing that rabbit down the hole, we want to focus on agreeable terminology and agreeable pieces of what the caucuses can agree upon for the definition of off-channel habitat and bring those as consensus important pieces that can go into a rulemaking or board manual development. So we won't actually write the rule, but we'll bring the pieces that are important to each caucus in a consensus format as much as possible.
Sorry. Board members, would you answer your question?
Yes, thank you.
Okay. Anybody else have questions on off-channel habitat? Okay.
Okay, so that frankly is the easy one of the bunch here. So we'll move into probably the more challenging part, the more substantive part of the discussion, which we shorthand a lot as sort of electrofishing, but really it is broader than that. It really is really looking at the protocol survey approach relative to the physicals approach, and looking at this as sort of a package rule. How do we modernize, you know, that the use of that tool? I think the first step in that approach is deciding where it's appropriate to use the tool. And so we went through an exercise, again, relating back to the board motion, of looking at existing information. And the AMPA brought together a group of scientists and practitioners to kind of help establish where that is within, you know, how the range of application of that technology is being used, and to see if there, you know, sort of can be agreement reached at the practitioner level on sort of where and when that tool can be used. And so that, I'm going to be very vague here because this is not my area of expertise. I'm going to turn to the people on my left and right to dive in a little bit. So that process has been completed. We also have to have a conversation about kind of, you know, the idea of, okay, use of electrofishing as part of a protocol survey tells you part of the story. You know, it tells you that, you know, you have seen a fish, and at some point when you're using that tool, you no longer observe fish presence. And so that's not just where we stop. We've got to look at whether or not there's additional habitat up and beyond that point. And so that also takes some additional work and some additional questions and getting around concepts like likely to be used by, you know, and, you know, recoverable, and some of these terms that are embedded in the, you know, the baseline documents of this program. How do you translate those both into a rule and guidance, but also how you can do that in practice? And I think that's where the group is going to have to really work hard in the time we have remaining on this to kind of suss that out. But I'll pause there, and I'm going to ask Ray and then Hans to maybe elaborate a little bit more on that, because you've got a lot more expertise on that than I.
So although or Hans had convened electrofishing experts from most of the caucuses, we do have a report, and I think that report's available. And now that report is being passed on to another group of folks, some of which participated in the e-fishing technical group, some did not, to look at the report and protocol survey method and make recommendations back to policy about the PSM and whether or not there are some areas that we need to address with the information provided in the technical report. But it's not perfect, and consensus is tough in some instances, so we're trying to focus on interest-based negotiation and working with folks to make sure that their base caucus interests are upheld and being true to the board assignment, and trying to answer some of those questions about reduction and use of the tools. And Hans can talk more about the technical part.
Yes, I'd be happy to talk about that. The first intent was to convene this group to look at questions that had been raised by the board and by policy, come up with a mission on how to be efficient and thoughtful when using electrofishing, and how to minimize its use when it isn't the appropriate tool. So that was what the group did. They produced a report. You all have a copy of the report. I would point you to the executive summary as just a good overview of the issues. And then if you want more detail, it's in the report. Now that group put together some recommendations on how to move forward. But it wasn't explicit about the big picture of moving forward in water typing in general. It was just around protocol survey electrofishing. And in that process, there were other issues that were brought up by that technical group and the practitioners, in places that they thought there was further dialogue that would be helpful constructive. And so what at the recommendation of TFW policy, we put together a group of a subset of the practitioners and also a representative from Eastern Washington that hadn't been able to participate just due to logistics. And that group is meeting to then look at the next step. So taking that report and other things to look at places where we would refine or make improvements on the existing board manual section 13, which is protocol surveys. And so the next step is really looking at features that will help define the regulatory break between F and N waters. And electrofishing, yes, it's a big piece of it. It's really the big piece of, and it's not so much about presence, because if you see a fish with your eyes, you don't need to electrofish. It's more about the places where you would want to show absence or not having leadership. That is the, that's where the difficulty lies. And this group is going to try to tackle it. And when we put together the group, it was, the idea was to represent the spectrum of perspectives. And so individuals were actually asked because, one, they had either been part of the group before, been very collaborative, despite having many disagreements on the report and in the pieces putting it together, but they were constructive and thoughtful, but also have expertise in the subject. So it really is, it's going to be a difficult exercise because of the range of perspectives, but it's going to be ultimately a lot more helpful to the group moving forward because we're capturing that group. And the people that are participating, I can tell you, are all enthusiastic and wanting to find a solution here to bring to the board. So it's a real positive step. It's a necessary step to work out some of those issues that are focused in electroefficient for now, but it's more broad than that, looking at the entire protocol surveys.
Okay. So questions?
Board members have questions about the status of electroefficient in the context of the matrix.
I have a question.
Board member Davies.
Can you speak to the issue around the permit? And I just would like some clarification. We are not allowed to, under the current HCP, electroefficient is not covered, but there is a way, there's another permit that allows. And I just would like some discussion on how long that is. Is there a limit? Is there a trigger? Is there a reporting process or deadline?
You're right. It's not a covered, it's not a permitted activity. However, there are ways to be permitted for electrofishing. You need to start with a scientific collection permit from the Department of Fish and Wildlife. You need a Section 10 permit from, or a incidental take permit. NOAA Fisheries and the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service if there are listed species present. And then that, those are the agencies that permit the activities for collecting fish. DNR doesn't regulate any of that. Now, it's how the data are used. And with respect to the HCP, it's not a covered activity, but if we do research using electrofishing as part of the adaptive management program, then there is a reporting requirement for electrofishing, but not in determining the FN break. Does that help?
Any other questions from board members on water typing status? Okay.
Okay, so we're going to move on to physicals. Right now under the existing rule, there's sort of two ways you can establish the regulatory break. We just talked about one, protocol surveys. The other one is using default physical characteristics, so measures of width and slope in the stream and relationships. I believe also include basin size. Part of taking a look at this rule as a package, many caucuses felt that it was important to also take a look at the physicals. And I'm not going to get into the policy reasons why, but suffice to say, that was important to bring everybody along. And I personally appreciate everybody who didn't think this was important to sort of recognize that it was important for getting to hopefully a consensus set of recommendations. The landowners, large forest landowners, did submit a proposal initiation to the AMPA. The AMPA then responded to that proposal initiation. And this process that we go through with proposal initiations and policy right now around some of these topics, this wasn't the only one that was filed, really do help put some framework around a otherwise sort of nebulous set of conversations. It really helps people focus on what we need to look at. And it gives it to someone who can objectively take a look at that request and make some informed recommendations, and that's the role of the AMPA. And so the AMPA provides then some recommendations back to policy, as he did in this particular case. Policy can adopted verbatim. Policy can ignore whatever they else want, but it generally helps narrow the focus of responses. And I think it was quite successful in this particular case, because it took something that could be, you know, viewed as widely controversial and really helped it narrow down to some discrete steps that people felt comfortable moving forward. And so at our policy meeting was last week, we did adopt portions of the AMPA's recommendations. And I'm going to let the AMPA summarize those because, well, he wrote them.
Thank you, Adrian. So in May of 2016, the Washington Forest Protection Association submitted a proposal initiation on the physicals. And we had some discussion at the June meeting and a little more at the July meeting. And so for our August meeting, I made some recommendations on ways to address the different places where there was interest in the proposal initiation. So I made a set of recommendations. The first, they were broken out into three phases. The first phase was
Is this what you provided to us?
Yes.
So we can follow along.
Yes. Thank you, Board Member. That's right, you do have this in your packet. There's two attachments. One is the memorandum dated August 9, 2016. The other is the memorandum dated July 21, 2016. The July 21, 2016 are my recommendations to policy, and the August 9th are the recommendations that policy has agreed to in consensus and moving forward. And so there were three phases. The first phase I'll characterize as a look backward, looking at how we got where we are. So it's investigating the data, the assumptions, the steps, the process in arriving at the default physical criteria. That's the first phase. The second and third phase are more related to research in a data analysis exercise, looking at the physical features in the physical default criteria and seeing if they are the appropriate ones, if there are ways to make improvements, and a number of different paths forward, if you will, to making some changes to the current physical defaults, or potentially arriving at the same place, but doing it in a more rigorous way. And so my recommendations were to forego the looking backward piece and to focus on these research questions, put them in a science track, and do a thorough evaluation. We have an adaptive management program now that wasn't around when we were working on, or when the default physical criteria were established. And so now we have a rigorous, methodical approach and program that is set up to deal with these types of questions in a more transparent and objective way. And so I think it would do us, the program, some good to do that. So policy took those three areas of recommendation and they said, well, we still think we want to do this look backward piece. So I had some ideas on how to do that. So that was the first phase that they agreed to. And the second phase, which had two steps. The first step was to assemble a technical group, look at the two phases in the PI, and identify the approach in a way to move forward. And the idea was that if a study would be helpful, if there are data that exist, how they might be incorporated, just to get, you know, a little bit of perspective on how to move forward in establishing or evaluating or creating default physical criteria, whichever the case may be. And so each one of those steps I put together, and you'll see it in the memorandum dated August 9, 2016, the phase that's identified from the PI and also the timeline. So for the phase one, the expectation is 6 months with an expected cost of somewhere between $75,000 and $100,000. And the phases two and three, the step one that they selected was to assemble the technical group and to look at relevant data and literature and determine the next steps for evaluating physical default criteria and then providing your report to policy. And I expected that one was also going to be around 6 months with an expected cost of somewhere around $75,000 to really thoroughly analyze all nine items that are in phases two and three. And so the total for both of those would be up to $175,000. And those were the recommendations from TFW policy.
So why don't we go ahead and do questions on this piece, and then we'll talk about kind of how we're going to, well, we decided to do the model and mapping, and then we'll talk about how we're going to kind of wrap this together.
Yeah. So questions from board members, Board Member Store, excuse me.
Is there any reason to think about small forest landowners differently? Maybe that's the wrong word, but have other approaches with physicals than we do with the large?
I'll take a whack at that. You know, to be candid, I don't believe in the sense of implementation specifically with the physicals that's been brought up at TFW policy. I don't want to speak for the small forest landowners, but generally they're pretty focused on looking at implementation issues, and I expect that in the broad scheme of things, if you're looking at a water typing system, I think physicals are probably closer to what small forest landowners would be able to implement sort of on their own, as opposed to a protocol survey, which requires additional permitting, training, etc. But I should probably stop there before I get in trouble with another Mr. Miller in the audience.
Thank you.
Good questions from Board Member Stanley. I just wanted to clarify, you think you can get the phases one, two, and three done at the same time, concurrently?
So phase one and step one of the phases two and three, those could be done concurrently. Yes.
I should add on this approach, a big part of this was, let's not commit to a full-blown research evaluation of the physical defaults until we gather some information. So this is taking a bite of the elephant, and we can see at that point in time if it still is important. I liken it to, you know, the likely, you know, the potential for a recommendation or more research on the off-channel habitat piece. It may be needed for somebody to be able to say yes as we put this together, and if so, we'll take it up then. Like this, after we get some information back, it may be important for a caucus to keep going in this process, but we don't want to presuppose it is or isn't. We don't want to make commitments to spending money until we have a better sense of both the political balance and the information itself.
Board Member Janicki.
So on phase one, am I correct in understanding, so the collection of additional data, I mean, 20 years has passed since the initial data was collected, and that initial information was from just a very narrow geographic area on the peninsula, is that correct?
Much of it was, yes, most of it was. That's right. There were other data sets that were used, but that's where it started, and that was where the data were the most, they were the most robust, I should say.
So, address that a little bit.
Well, can I take that a little bit? And I don't think it's so much important that we look at the data as an important function of these next steps with the physical criteria, but understanding the underpinnings and philosophy behind how it was done, and so that we can shape the next steps either more appropriately or similarly based on those original, you know, we all had sort of biases going in, and we all have biases now. So we can use that information to help shape the future, then we'll do that. And so that's the important part of that first step. So not so much that the data that was used, but the philosophy of how it was used.
So I would say methods versus looking at methods and visiting kind of the methodologies as opposed to the use of the data itself. Is that Am I getting there? I'm trying, I'm reading facial expressions, and I know we're not getting it there.
Well, I just, you know, I guess, I'm used to taking in data from all different, you know, lots of different sources, and kind of distilling it, percolating it, and hopefully coming up with a better answer. 20 years has passed, and when there's a you know, italicized print here that says, and other contributors of data, I just, if there's going to be something political, it seems like it would be really political as to where this additional data that is going to be included or not included comes from. And I guess I'm just flat out asking the question, how political is this in pulling in new or additional or more current data?
So the first step is only, think of it as a retrospective analysis. It's not even, in fact, analysis might not be the right word. It's more creating the information as best as possible, and with the full knowledge that not all of the data are even going to be found 20 years later, like you said, to try to reconstruct how the defaults were arrived at. That's it. And the reason I didn't recommend it is because I don't see a lot of utility in that moving forward, and I'm looking forward. That's why I wanted to focus on, if we want to have the best physicals that are accurate and minimize error and all of the objectives, then we need to start from scratch and build a study around that question instead of taking information to try to get an answer. That's my response.
So to directly answer your question, now that I understand it better, it absolutely was an important part of the consensus recommendation. So some caucuses needed that to be able to move forward. That's how this process works. I should say that not everyone around the table was enthusiastically supportive of this particular step, but it was important for the group to get consensus.
Thank you.
Other questions from board members? Okay, why don't we have the report on the modeling, and then you guys can bring it all together, right? This off, Adrian? You gonna lead off?
Adrian?
All right. Sorry.
Yes, I'd be happy
yes,
to.
Yes,
I'd be happy to. Let them
eat. Okay, I'm there with the shirt alone.
I'd be happy to. I believe it was my time in this process. Forest Practices Board made the recommendation to the Adaptive Management Program Administrator at the time to scope and initiate a pilot project to rerun the existing hydrologic model using LIDAR data. So I'm happy to be here today to report that is what we have done. We're fortunate to work with the UW Precision Forestry Cooperative, some real experts in the remote sensing world, and we're fortunate enough to hear about this project today from Jeff Komnek here. Luke Rogers was not able to be available. He was on vacation, and also Dr. Moscow is here as well to answer any questions, and I just thank them for being here.
Okay, so my name is Jeff Komnek, and I'll be doing the presentation. This is Luke's work, unfortunately, so I'm going to do my best to present his work. He was really disappointed not to be able to be here today to present it.
I'm Monica Moskal. I'm the director of the Precision Forestry Cooperative. My other hat is the associate director of the School of Forest and Environmental Sciences at the University of Washington, and I'm one of the male professor as well in that school. My expertise is in LIDAR, so I have over 10 years expertise in that. If Jeff can't answer any questions, I can attempt to answer them for you as well.
Okay, so again, the scope of what we're going to do here today is limited to just rerunning the existing models. And so the sort of background, brief background here, and that should say 10 meter or 30 foot there in the upper right corner. The background is the Forest Practices HCP specified that the DNR should map out fish stream locations, fish and no fish locations on forested lands in the state of Washington. And a model was developed that, and also that the model should achieve a 95% success rate in classifying points along the stream network as fish or no fish, and that the error should be approximately even, overestimating and underestimating. And the report that was developed, or the model that was developed, got quite close in doing that, but didn't quite make the 95% target. And the authors identified several sources of error at that point, including things that were related to the quality of the 10-meter USGS digital elevation model that they thought could be improved using the high-resolution LIDAR-derived DEMs. Those include passages, fish barrier passages, the quality of the accuracy of the location of LIDAR or DEM-derived stream networks, and also the inaccuracies in the hydrology of the watersheds that impacted contributing area to points along the stream network. So the model is a two-step model. It's a logistic regression equation to predict fish or no fish presence at points along the stream network, and then a heuristic stopping rule is applied in those areas where there's both fish and non-fish points sort of in the same area. So I'll talk a little bit more about that. With the help of the DNR, we identified two watersheds to run. Our criteria here was we needed the LIDAR coverage, and we also needed water type modification forms, which provided the end of fish points that we could use to have the ground truth data where the fish no fish areas are. So we selected one on the east side and one on the west side, watershed that is. On the west side, the Michelle watershed has a number of larger streams. You can see there down around Mount Rainier and Pack Forest. On the east side, we use the Darlin Mountain watershed. It's a little bit simpler with just the two forks of the Atanum Creek. So there's some differences that we'll see there, some limitations on the east side watershed, but those were the ones that we selected. The methodology, again, this was doing our best to simply re-implement the original model. The documentation was fantastic, so we were able to do that as best we could. We think very close, but there are a lot of small details that we sort of had to address as we implemented the model. So first, we built digital elevation models from the LIDAR. We built three resolutions, a 3-foot, a 10-foot, and a 30-foot resolution digital elevation model. And then we also used the USGS 10-meter DEM. For each of those DEMs, we generated streams using flow accumulation algorithms. Along those stream networks, we created points at about 10-meter spacing along the streams. We attributed for each of those streams, for each of those points, the independent variables that go into the logistic regression model. So basin area, precipitation, upstream and downstream gradients, elevation, and then some other variables that we use to sum up the results. We use the DNR water type modification forms to digitize the end of fish points. And we had some issues with that I'll talk about a bit, but we were able to identify digitize enough of those onto the DNR hydro layer that we could then transfer those to the DEM-derived stream layers to identify actual fish and no fish points. Then we ran the logistic regression to predict the fish presence probability, ran the stopping rule to identify when you come to a the first no fish, if there's a large block of fish beyond that, we then identified that area as also fish until we reached a point where it was inadequate fish above a no fish point. And then we generated our summary maps and statistics. So you can see here for Darlin Mountain, there were 12 end of fish points identified from water type modification forms that we could use to generate our sort of validation data set. So for each of those points above, each of those end of fish points above, those points were the no fish points and below were the fish points. And I should also mention that we followed the convention of the original report authors, which is to use only fourth order streams below the end of fish points. So we didn't count as fish all the way down to the initiation point of the watershed, since that would balance or bias the study that way. So from this, we got about 2,000 fish points and 2,000 no fish points, which we didn't think was enough to be confident, but was enough to give us some idea of some trends. That shows there the location of the various, the two data sets, fish and no fish. So the model results here, using just the logistic regression model, we can see that in all cases, the percent that was predicted correct was fairly high, and the stopping rule generally improved that further. So there isn't really a whole lot to go with here, but when we look at specific examples, the and we're also reporting then what the error distances are from the end of fish points, the actual end of fish points and the modeled end of fish points, and that's shown there. When we look at a specific example though on the in the Darlin Mountain watershed, the authors identified that the Eastside model over-predicted fish presence due to the inability to detect the fish barriers, bedrock cascades, for example. And what we found in two cases here was that the LIDAR was able to detect those barriers, whereas the USGS model was not. The 10-meter DEM was not able to detect those. So again, although we don't have enough to speak more confidently, it seems like the LIDAR did improve the model. On the west side, the Michelle watershed, we had 131 water type modification forms, end of fish points that we could use to generate our validation data set. We had about 20,000 fish and 20,000 non-fish points to use, so we had a little bit more to work with there. And again, the results, in this case, the results did seem to suggest that increasing the resolution of the DEM improved the results of the model. We found the same trend as the authors, that the Westside model tended to underpredict the amount of fish presence. But the increase in resolution seemed to improve that problem. And again, the stopping rule increased the accuracy of correctly classifying fish and no fish points. So in this case, again, you can see the error distances and the average error distance from actual and modeled end of fish points. This is a pretty typical case in the example where the yellow triangles are the actual end of fish points, and the modeled fish presence in all cases doesn't go as far up as the light blue DNR hydro model. The model is just under predicting the amount of fish presence on the west side in these stream types. So I wanted to highlight a couple of challenges that we found in using the higher resolution digital elevation model. Here is the DNR hydro layer, and the light blue, or the blue is the fish, and gray is no fish. And if you overlay the stream, the DEM generated 10 meter streams, it looks pretty close. Similarly for the 30 foot LIDAR derived stream network. But when you move up towards the to the 10 foot resolution, it looks a little bit different. And then when you go to the 3 foot, it looks completely different, completely removed from reality. And what we're seeing cutting across the hillside there is the road network. If you turn on the high resolution LIDAR DEM, you can actually see the roads, whereas the lower resolution DEMs, they don't find those roads. So the good news for the RMAP compliance officer is that the road is doing what it should be doing, the water's routing down the ditch network, just as it should. Unfortunately, we don't know where the cross drains are, we don't know where the culverts are, we don't know how to route the water off the road network and back into the stream networks. So this is a pretty significant problem whenever we use flow accumulation models with LIDAR-derived DEMs. We are trying an effort to identify sinks where water is building up behind the roads, and then identifying those as the likely places where culverts would occur, and we can essentially burn culverts into the DEM to get the water across the road. So we think there's a chance that that will be helpful. I think we have an example here. So these digital culverts improve the situation slightly. We still don't know where cross drains are. So it's a big problem. The other problem that we ran into was stream gradients. If we look at the sort of main channel that's cutting across here from the lower left to the upper right in the picture and up to the yellow and the fish point, we can see that the four DEM-derived stream networks are approximately in the same area. But if we look at a profile of the stream gradients across that stretch, if we look at the 10-meter DEM, the slopes are fairly low until the very end where one spikes up to 30%, and that's actually where the model, the USGS model, predicts the end of fish for that stretch. If we turn on the 30-foot LIDAR drive, yeah, it looks pretty similar. But then when we go to the 10-foot and the 3-foot, the slopes look quite different. And the result of this is that we're getting, even when we average these across 100 meters, which is how the upstream and downstream slopes are developed, we still find that we're getting much higher slopes using the high resolution digital elevation models. Now, in this case, the USGS model actually overpredicts by about half a mile because some of the early slopes actually were steep gradients that restricted fish passage at that point. But generally speaking, it just shows how the original model was developed for 10 meter DEMs and not for the higher resolution LIDAR drive DEMs, and that we just need to look at some of these types of questions rather than simply reapply the existing model. So a few conclusions. It does appear, again, using with fairly limited evidence, but it does appear that the LIDAR improved the east and west side models for predicting fish presence. But some of the challenges associated with LIDAR can be listed there, including the methodology that was really developed for the lower resolution 10-meter DEMs to develop the independent variables using the regression equation. The unrealistic stream networks because of the road network. The data sets are much larger, so it takes a little bit longer to run using the LIDAR, the 3-foot LIDAR in particular. Obviously, we don't have LIDAR data everywhere, and there's a lot more streams, and depending on how you define the perennial initiation point, that number can change quite a bit, actually. We found that not all water type modification forms were equally useful for identifying end of stream or end of fish points. And we also found that because the LIDAR or the DEM derived stream networks were so different in some cases from the DNR hydro stream, we didn't always know how to move the end of fish point from one stream network to the other with confidence. And finally, we do have all this process now coded up, so relatively quickly to rerun different alternatives. And a few quick recommendations of what we found that we could move forward with these with this project. We could investigate developing the independent variables for the logistic regression equation more appropriately for high resolution DEMs. We can look at using these digital culverts to improve our stream flow across the road networks. A little bit larger project then is to expand the pilot study to include additional watersheds, which would certainly be useful in on the east side of Darling Mountain. Possibly including additional field verified end of fish data. We do have the coding platform now to run different alternatives relatively quickly. We can leverage that. And then one thing we didn't look into, which is a much, much bigger project, is actually reformulating the logistic model, refitting the model, new parameters, things like that, for high resolution DEMs natively. I think that's it. I'll answer any questions you have.
Board member questions for Jeff? Board member Alice?
Maybe displaying my ignorance here, but I know DNR received some funding to start doing more landslide mapping around the state using LIDAR. Are those the same data sets that could be used for this type of work? I mean, would there be an efficiency in having that information available?
So yes, the DNR received some funding for their geology, for the state geologist to focus. Those priorities are being looked at from a public safety perspective, which includes not only things that Forest Practices cares about, but also things like beach erosion and volcanic issues and et cetera. So the good news is we got funding. It's not to do the whole state, and so it's going to be a multi-year process to acquire all the LIDAR we need to cover the areas that don't have any.
We could use those data sets.
Yeah. Other questions from other board members?
I've got a couple. So I, two things I noticed. One was your small sample of water type mods for the East Side Basin. So what influence did that have on your results compared to the many different water type mods you had on the West Side Basin?
I mean, again, I think primarily the big thing is just limited confidence in did we cover enough different scenarios that are occurring over there, enough different stream types. I think that would be the main issue that we see at this point.
Okay, and then the other, and I may not be reading these results right, but I, under Darling Mountain results, it was clearly a better, the error was reduced in a major way, a big time way for the east side. I did not see that same effect on, if I understand your table on average error distance, I didn't see a significant improvement on the west side basin. Is that correct? Am I reading these tables right?
Yes, I believe that is correct. I think the west side model continued to underpredict the amount of fish presence. I think the trend is positive there. The other issue with the average air distance is in with the USGS model, when it missed, it oftentimes missed by quite a bit. And so it had, or maybe what I should say is it had a fair number of small errors and then some very large errors. And it seemed like the LIDAR models also may have done a little bit better with that, but the average air distance presented here doesn't really allow us to dig into that more. So I think Luke's going to, when he writes the report, he's gonna break that out a little bit further and allow us to see some of the performance a little bit better.
Okay.
I think on the east side, it might be related to, again, the limited stream situations that we have, which is why we correctly classified at such a high rate. And it's also a less complex watershed.
Ah, okay.
Did you want to add anything, Hans?
No, I...
Before we move back to the...
You know, I think the one of the biggest take-home messages is in the recommendations piece and talking about kind of where to go from here. You know, with full recognition that this was a pilot, we were looking for existing data. East side LIDAR data when we started this was really hard to find. Since that time, the Colville National Forest has been collecting better data in that part of the state, which we didn't have available for this pilot. So Darlin Mountain, there are even some segments of Darlin Mountain that were missing, but it was really the best thing we had. And so we were really limited on the east side by where we could even do this. There were some questions. And then Michelle, of course, had the opposite problem. There was a lot of data. A very complex watershed, so it made it almost in some ways the worst case comparison east and west, but it gives some inference on both sides that I think is useful. But I think those recommendations are really important, and I would just like to point out the last bullet, that if we really wanted to build a model using LIDAR, we wouldn't try to make it fit with an old logistic regression model and then just applying a new DEM. We would really want to do this the right way. And this, you know, the $3 signs there associated with that, that's a reflection of reality. To do this the right way, it's going to take some money. And, you know, just so moving forward, I think that's something to think about. And then also time. You know, we have to have the available LIDAR or else pay to have the LIDAR flown. It's got to be done at the right resolution, the right time of year, all those things. So the investment piece here is a real important consideration for you all to decide as we're moving forward with the Type F permanent rule.
Okay. Board Member Davies.
Thank you. I just you mentioned that you were shooting for a 95% confidence and didn't quite get there, but then each watershed was slightly different, just slightly under 95. Is that right?
The original forest practice HCP called for the 95% okay. Success classification rate.
And so can you say again what you did reach for each of those? Well, they were separate for each of the watersheds?
I think they were, yeah, Darlin Mountain was all in the 98%
okay,
and
so
above.
Okay, so got above. That's
yeah.
Why I want to make sure that I
yeah.
Read that. Okay, and it was like 88 for the, so I understood that.
Yeah, it was the original study that missed the 95% target.
Okay.
Yeah.
And I'm just curious, how long did it take you to do just one of those watersheds? A person sitting down for a week or just?
I know Luke worked on programming the model for months.
Okay.
At that point, that took 3 days to run the highest resolution model.
So if we had more data, which it sounds like we do now, and you then spend all that time programming the model, there should be some efficiency in
absolutely.
Redoing it. And so if we had data for one watershed on each side of the state, and now there's more, about how many more could we do now, do you think?
The locating of the end of fish points from the water type modification forms are manual, and beyond that, there's some data processing involved, but fairly quickly.
I would just want to add something as a note of caution. Using the water type mods this way, it was a way to have a common currency for comparison. But when you're talking about accuracy of the model in an absolute sense, I don't think that would be the data set that I would want to just rely on. So moving forward and thinking about that, I don't think that would be the right way to go.
Board Member Sabine.
So following up on Board Member Davis's excellent questions, and you emphasized the recommendations quite a bit. My take on from those recommendations is that there could be some significant payoff to actually pursuing trying to construct the model from scratch and trying to see if it would work. And then that payoff could translate into, you know, solving some of the issues that we've been grappling with quite a bit. So you had an accurate model, the Holy Grail, the Silver Bullet. It could make life a lot easier and more efficient. And so I guess my big picture question is, how do we evaluate whether or not it's worth asking for the resources to pursue this?
Well, good question. Part of the what I'm gonna, or staff will suggest to us for moving forward will be actually having TFW policy look at the study and figuring out how it fits in with this bigger package of work they've been doing. Because this is the first time they've seen it too. They haven't seen this presentation at all. I'm sure they're going to have probably a lot more questions than they do. So.
Because they're smarter than we are.
No, I didn't say that. Let's just say. I'm not going to bite on that one. Board Member Stanley. It's getting to that time of day.
More cake.
Another chunk of cake.
Yeah.
Just clarification, if we went forward on a big project, kind of the thing in my head hit is, what if it doesn't hit the 95% and we waste money or have other decisions to make? How confident are you on a confidence level?
Yeah, I don't know. That's moving above my pay grade pretty fast.
I think to some degree that would be both TFW policy discussion as well as a board discussion on what risk level are we going to accept.
I would throw one other thought there, that rather than buy everything and decide to go forward, really carefully think about the areas where the model really missed. I'm thinking about the Northwest region in particular, you know, steep geology, glacial outwash, you know, Skagit, Nooksack basins. That's where it really missed. And if you did, I hate to use the word pilot, but if you set up a project to do it the right way, where you already have existing LIDAR data, which is nice, you might try it there. And then that would be a I would recommend that might be a go, no go decision point based on what you get there. If you can get to the 95%, then you've got a real question to wrestle with. But I think that might be a more prudent way to go rather than, you know, signing up for the whole thing.
Any other questions from board members? Member Davies?
Since we have the expert here, how much of the state is covered by LIDAR?
I would say less than about 50%. So, and some of that coverage is quite old, and I would think it's out of date. The LIDAR technology changes on almost yearly basis. So the way we evaluate it is anything before about 2005, I wouldn't be running these type of models on those data sets. And the Athenum data was poor quality in comparison to the Michelle data set. So you're always going to have that problem that by next year, we'll have better LiDAR, and a year later, better LiDAR. That is actually a common issue with remote sensing technology.
Hopefully cheaper.
Yeah. Cheaper, yeah.
Any other questions from board members? Thank you both for coming down from UW to provide that presentation. Is there anything else, Hans, that you want to wrap that up before Adrian and Ray come back up to sort of give us the bigger picture?
No, I think that covers it.
Thank you very much. So how are you going to work this miracle?
And so before we go there, there's one other sort of map related data management kind of piece that I think is important to call out. I was scanning back to see if I could see Jim Peters out there because he had a wonderful metaphor about this at our last policy meeting. But basically this is the concept of, you know, if we know where surveys have been conducted, and that information is easily and readily available to practitioners, whether they're a large landowner or a small, you can make a lot of inferences about classification of your water course without having to even go in the field. And so knowing that a survey has taken place, knowing that an ID team has taken place, knowing that that was approved through the water type mod process or whether it was approved for an FPA, and then looking where you are on the stream network relative to that point, i.e. if you're downstream and there was water type mod form that established an FN break that went through an ID team, you can be pretty confident that you're in an F water without having to do electrofishing. Getting that information that's on paper into a system is beginning to happen, but I think, you know, looking at tools that can then make that alarmingly apparent to the general public would be an important process step that policy has discussed that's somewhat related to this topic. So there's some administrative things that I can see part of this larger package.
Well, thank you for setting me up for that. Okay. Because what I want to commit to the board is that I'm directing the DNR Forest Practices operational staff to update the DNR hydro layer that clearly shows the full extent of the type of waters from protocol surveys or IDTs on down the stream. And this alone will result in fewer electrofishing or protocol surveys. And we'll also be assessing the status of the data layer and whether it needs a technical update to current technology to meet the objectives of these efforts.
I think that would be welcomed. So in terms of kind of putting this together, I want to kind of take a step back here because, you know, when we're having the discussion around the physicals, we were talking about policy consensus, and one of the things I missed in that conversation was the concept that we were working with, which is provisional consensus. We want to provide a complete package to the board, a suite of recommendations that are going to cover all of the topics we've addressed today. We're taking this sort of incrementally by subject matter and seeing how close to consensus we can get on each individual piece, and then we'll put a package together. So when we communicate that policy reached consensus on an element of a set of recommendations, I want to be very clear that not everybody's ready to say, yes, go do that. They want to say, yes, but I want to see the other pieces first. And so I think that's very important to reflect to the board of kind of how we're doing this. I think that's a constructive approach. It gives people the space they need to evaluate how important is that particular issue to them without having to sort of lay down a hard policy block in the conversation. So it's a technique to build consensus on the larger piece. And I think it's having incremental success in that regard. So really that is sort of a way of disclosing that I should have said that earlier, but really is a reflection of how we're going to put this together. And I think you've seen the range of topics. You know, we will get into minutia detail
And then we'll have to kind of pull back up and think about what is the key part of the recommendations. Either Hans or Ray mentioned earlier the idea we're not going to be bringing, you know, draft rule language. We understand that there's a process by which rule language is developed, but we will be bringing language that says these three elements need to be put in rule. These three elements need to be part of a board manual process. These three studies need to be done. And it'll be across those range of topics. So really just sort of bringing people along as elements fall in place, there's more certainty, people get more comfortable, and hopefully people are comfortable enough to say yes to a comprehensive package. Is there anything else, Ray, you want to add to that?
More art than science, and consensus is squishy. We're going to do the best we can. We're going to try to bring you consensus on the entire package. We likely will not have that, but we will strive in places where we don't have full consensus to bring you options to consider. I hate the term minority-majority reporting. We'll try to bring you solution-based options. So we can arm you with good decision pathways, even though we've tried to organize that in a consensus way. We'll do the best we can.
Thank you. Other questions for the panel? Board Member Sadiq.
Well, I actually have a question for you based on what Ray just said, or maybe it's a question for you guys. But from a procedural perspective, I really like the way you guys are constructing this and you know, doing your very best to get to consensus. And I also like the sound of options if you can't quite get there, and that does seem like it arms us with good decision making. Are there any procedural blockages to us being able to make a decision about a rule package if there's lack of 100% consensus? So if they come to us and say, well, you know, we got 80% there, we got 85% there, and then here's some options on the things that we didn't, can we just go ahead and put a rule package together based on that?
As long as nobody raises the dispute resolution issue. So if they bring us a package that includes options where there isn't full consensus, then we're free to move forward.
So I'll put this in a more positive construct. We're going to bring you an update as to where we're at in that process. Mm-hmm. Wherever we are in November, you're going to hear where we're at. I'm a little more optimistic than my co-chair, but we'll see who's right. But presuming he's correct, and we're not at full consensus, what I think we can is fairly describe the points of tentative agreement that we've reached and the points where we're not in agreement. I think we will do a very careful job to explain why on the places we're not, and I can guarantee you there'll be a line of public commenters behind me and reaching out to all of you in advance to share in explicit detail their points of view on that. At that point, it is up to the board in terms of how they want to move forward in terms of formal direction, but that is our plan, is to bring that forward, and then we'll respond.
Any other questions from board members to the panel before we go to public comment on this?
I just want to say I appreciate that plan to provide options if you don't get there, even though it sounds like you've got some momentum and you're working really hard, and really appreciate that. And the options will allow us to get moving, so thank you.
And I'd just caution the term dispute resolution. This is a response to past dispute resolution, likely, 3 years in the making? So, are you going to dispute the dispute? So just caution people not to, it's not going to be perfect, but it's going to be the best we can do, and we'll get there. I think we're closer than people would think if they were to kind of gauge this. We're fairly close.
Any other questions from the panel? Board Member Bowers.
more a request than a question. When you, if you do end up having to bring us options, I hope that there's clear delineation of what the pros and cons of each option are, so we can weigh them.
When I say options, that's kind of what I mean is, you know, sort of, there'll be, options is a very choice word, but yeah. It won't be a majority report because I think those don't necessarily build us the collaborative kind of approach that we want, but certainly we could point out where here's an approach and here's the pros and cons associated with it, here's an approach. And we could tease out the pieces of those majority and those different pieces, but we're not going to bring you typical, hopefully not bring you typical majority report.
Any other questions from the board members? Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you.
So I'm going to go down my list of people that have signed up to talk about water typing. Peter Goldman, would you be up first, please?
Good afternoon. My name is Peter Goldman, and I'm the director of the Washington Forest Law Center, a participant in the Conservation Caucus. The last panel was very interesting and somewhat preempted some of the things I was going to say. So I'll reduce my remarks. I'd like to address, though, what I think is the main general impediment facing this board and the state of Washington Forest Practice Rules today, and that's, again, inaction by the board improving and updating the forest practice rules due to some kind of delay in the adaptive management process, and specifically in the policy committee. And as we just heard, I think we can assume that this is best exemplified by the pace of the water typing issue in the policy committee. Just a little bit of history, the 1999